Christmas, 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 la 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 la. Christmas gets really tedious after a while. Christmas, Christmas, it's still Christmas apparently.
We're stuck in a fucking time loop. It's Christmas all over again here at the Bitter End Podcast with me, Tom Denny.
And me, Todd Jordan.
Because we're back in the... We can't escape this season because we're here to talk about Home Alone 2. Lost in New York?
It's like
Escape from New York?
Lost
in... Oh, imagine if it was Home Alone 2, Escape from New York.
That would have been banging. Missed a trick. But you're right, it is like a time loop. It feels like we're in a Twilight Zone episode where we're trapped inside a snow globe and it's like we're like looking out at the rest of the world and yes. Everyone's like on the beach playing volleyball.
Oh.
Like everyone's fucking... just their lives are moving on and here we are and it's still snowing and
still
with this little brat.
It's like the nightmare of that that wizard song, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, and this is what happens when you get what you wish for and you realize, oh no,
be careful what you wish
that's
for
what
kids.
Happens when you sell your soul to John Candy. You get the wish, but there's a twist in the tale. And that is that you just get stuck with fucking mac and cheese Culkin
coming at you. Welcome back to season 8.
Yeah.
We are kicking off, and as far as we can tell, we are still alive. Although, you know, my certainty is dropping. This might be some sort of hellish afterlife, as we have discussed. We're here to talk about Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, and we've just watched the fucking most brutal trailer I've ever seen.
Holy shit, this is bizarre. There must be other trailers that were made, but this one... Hoo doggy, it is the spiciest of Christmas meatballs.
Ah, yes, the traditional Christmas meatball meal.
Yeah.
It's like a karaoke song of like this Christmas carol that they've written. That's
of Deck the Halls.
It's Deck the Halls, but it's got Marvin Harry, little Joey Fishes, and big old Daniel Stern stretch himself, and they are getting the shit kicked out of them by Kevin. It's all the bits from the end of the movie, you know that. But the people singing the Christmas song are just like... kill them dead and chop their arms off. Smash their heads in, burn their corpses.
Yeah, it's just like... yeah.
Show no mercy. Make them regret being born.
They've just like done a song for the end bit of the movie. And the trailer for the first film, we were kind of like, well, it's everything you remember from the movie. It's the opening where he gets left behind. They miss out like the hour and 20 in the middle where he just meanders around and steals a toothbrush. And then the end bit that everybody remembers with all the slapstick violence. This is literally all of the slapstick violence. There is no reason to watch this film.
Dissolve their flesh in a vat of bleach. Make them identify them with dental records. It's just...
stab them in the fucking peen. Stabby, stabby, stab.
It's
in the
so
peen.
Violent. Now, the first one was a lot more cartoonish. And yeah. This one is just, it's murder.
There's a bit where Kevin is on the top of a building. He just gets a brick and hoys it straight into Marv's face. He's dead.
Yeah, forget Child's Play. This is a video nasty.
He's got brain bleed. He's dead. He drops a bag of spanners on little Joe Perry's head. He is also dead.
Little Joe Perry.
Joe Perry.
Wasn't he in Aerosmith?
Oh, fucking hell, yeah, he was. Him too. And Joe Pesci.
Hey all.
Hey, anyway.
We should probably get stuck in, bro.
We should get stuck in. There's many other things I remember from this film, none of which are represented in that. Fucking hell. In Home Alone 3... is Kevin going to just be taken into protective services?
No, man. He's going to be running around with a hockey mask and a fucking machete.
Yeah, he's like, it's like a Saw film, but for toddlers, I guess. Anyway, we should go and get fucking stuck into it. But before we do, Todd Jordan, you are back here for the Christmas favourite IMDb guessing game.
I'm going to be back again and again, Tom. I made a bad wish a long time ago.
Yes.
Sold my soul to a man in a yellow jacket, and we're paying for it.
We're in a weird kind of Groundhog Day scenario. Now, Home Alone from 1990, that got a fucking whopping 7.5. That is big bucks.
Yeah, it's a good film. I don't know if it's a 7.5er.
Right. Home Alone 2, Lost in New York from 1992. They've had 2 years off. Same director, Christopher Columbus.
Same writer still, John Hughes, the man behind 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club. I want to say Ferris Bueller's Day Off, that might be wrong.
Right, so the Dream Team, or Nightmare Team, as it were, they are back.
Yeah, I like the fact it's not 1 year later. It makes me think they kind of took their time.
Yep. And we've both seen this. You've got an idea of what you're going in for. Now, what do you think it scores?
I'm going to say it's dropped a whole point.
Yep.
6.5.
Mate, you're fucking close. 6.6.
Ah!
Now, that is a respectable film, and that is, that feels kind of more the right kind of ballpark for me.
Yeah, yeah.
If Home Alone 1 had been a 6.6, I'd be like, yep. And when you say Home Alone 2, 6.6, I'm like, yep. So...
yeah, I'm into that. Like, I don't want to watch, like, a sacred calf of a Christmas movie.
Do you think we're just too used to watching films that clock in at 6 or less? Like, we don't usually go higher. We're scared up there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like,
the air is thin.
Yeah, it makes me dizzy.
Yeah.
Aim low.
Yeah, I like to be really close to sea level. Anyway, that's what else is there to say? Let's just go and watch Kevin stab him in the peen.
Yeah.
And inevitably Dembala himself into one of their bodies.
I think he's going to Dembala himself into another one of his brothers.
Into, what's his name? Biff Tannen? Buzz? I don't know. I've never seen fucking the Back to the Futures, but I always just think, is he the same guy? Big flat top douchebag with a fucking varsity jacket?
Oh, Tom. Yes, listeners, he's not kidding. He's never seen Back to the Future.
This, you know, is... what? I can't be fucked.
Yeah, he's never.
I'm not going to now.
Because he's too busy watching Home Alone 2 Lost in New York.
Hey-oh!
Hello, it's me, the Mackenzie Culkin. I'm here to tell you about my adventures in Home Alone 2 Escape from New York, where I team up with the Snake Plissken and I fight the Joe Pesci and the Donald Trump.
You're a silly man, Tom Denny.
Oh.
You're a very silly man. You know what they should have called this movie? Not Home Alone 2 Lost in New York. They should have called this movie Home Alone 2 Hours is too long for a fucking children's movie.
It's fucking long. We thought the last one was long. I was like, saw this, like, hang about.
And 2 hours.
There's a bit where, like, oh, there's like all this stuff that happens in the film. Like, you know, I remember, like, they get the mix up on a plane. They go to New York. He checks into a hotel. Tim Curry's there. Everything's great. And, like, by the time he gets chased out of the hotel, I'm like, this is an hour in. Like, what else is going to happen in the rest of the film other than, like, him, like, defeating the Wet Bandits? But no, there's, like, a whole other hour for them to introduce whole other characters. Oh, fucking hell. Little bit of editing, maybe.
I mean, seriously, and I think there's quite a bit that ended up on the cutting room floor, even from what I've read. Like, this was for a film that, like, blow by blow does all of the beats of the first one. You get absolutely everything that happens in the first film. How is it longer?
Fuck knows, mate. Fuck knows. Because this is written. It's John Hughes who and he wrote it. And I think it was either him or director Christopher Columbus. No, Chris. Yeah. Whatever the.
It not, is Christopher Columbus, I think.
the guy who went to try and discover America. Chris Columbus, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway,
I'm sure his name's Christopher, though.
Yeah, actually, that's true. Christoph. Anyway, but they were both like, yeah, it's basically a remake of the first film, and it really is because. The opening scene is just the same. There's a lot of... I mean, you get that in any sequel where you're going to repeat, like, you know, favourite moments from the previous film. But, it's beat by beat is pretty much the same movie.
Yeah.
That said, there's a lot in this that I think I liked more than the first one.
Honestly, if you trim 40 minutes off this, it's the better of the two.
Yeah, yeah. And I was talking to my lovely wife about this film, and she's like, oh, I think this is my favourite of the two, because obviously it's not 3, 4, or 5. Her reasoning for it was like, well, when I was young, like, the idea of, like, going to, like, hotels and fancy hotels was exciting. So that is way, and it's quite the glamorous side of New York. This isn't scary Jason does Manhattan, like, scary New York.
There's no, like, toxic waste in barrels.
No, there's no barrel fires anywhere. This is very opulent, decadent New York. And so it's much more exciting to watch than being like, I stayed at home on my own, you know, like,
I did laundry.
Yeah, exactly. I went to the shops on my own to try and buy a toothbrush. Like, this is like going to, like, a fancy hotel and ordering room service and riding around in a limo and things like that. There's a lot more actual childhood escapism, wish fulfillment shit in this.
But it's weird because, I mean, we'll get to this, but, like, he demonstrably has a much better time. He has does a lot more fun
stuff.
Fuck
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, like, the novelty of it wears off for him much quicker this time. It doesn't take very long for him to be like, I miss my family.
Yeah, and I think that's partly because, like, I mean, he's not really home alone. He's in one of, like, the biggest, most buzzing cities in the world. So he gets ousted. He has to...
Tom, I got some beef here because he's not home.
He's not home, no.
He's not home.
Yeah.
He's not alone.
Yeah.
Right? He's in a hotel full of people.
Yeah.
He's not lost. He knows exactly where in New York he is. He knows the exact address. That's how he finds the hotel.
Yeah.
He is in New York. That's the only part of the title that is accurate.
Is it because the home where they live is now alone? There is actually no one there.
Well, then it's still not lost.
Doesn't explain lost
in New York. I call bullshit on that.
Yeah. Yeah, so like... Too long, but like I think actually a bit more fun than the first one. Maybe?
So let's dive in. Let's go through it beat by beat, and you know when we can't necessarily dwell on everything in great detail, but a lot of these beats, we've heard before.
Yeah,
right?
I like at the beginning it says based on characters by John Hughes, written by John Hughes. It's like. Did you have to? That's the same thing, mate. He's like, where can I get my... I want my name all over this fucking thing.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was... I read a fact saying that Chris Columbus was walking around New York and while they were shooting it, and kids came up to him and was like, "Why, mister, you're shooting a movie, you're shooting a movie." He was like, yeah, I'm the director of Home Alone 2. And they went, wow, we just met John Hughes. Sick burn
on him.
There
might be
some truth, Tom, to what you're implying.
Right? I see, right. And then we just like cut in. We're back in the McAllister house, and it's just like the opening shot of the...
It's chaos.
Everyone's running around. Everyone is still fucking horrible. So this time, they're all going on holiday again, but they're going to Florida, sunny Florida, and all the kids are talking about how tanned they're going to get. And it just seems like, man, times have changed. You couldn't have a kids' film where you've got... tweens just being like, man, I'm gonna bake in the fucking sun.
Yeah,
you're jealous because you don't tan. So it's like, okay, yeah.
But all the best characters are there. Like we get Buzz, the older brother, who's the guy with the pet tarantula. Now he gets a few moments in the sun throughout this. A recurring theme from me is going to be I love all of the characters in this film so much. Just without Kevin. And I want to see the whole film just be all of them looking for Kevin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then maybe we find him at the end, maybe for like one scene. I don't want to see what happens to Kevin.
But the thing
I want
is,
to see what happens to the rest of
them.
That
film of them looking for Kevin doesn't happen because whenever you cut to them, ain't no one giving no shits about Kevin.
Because they're
it's literally the mum. And even she is checked out a bit because obviously we all know that she sold her soul to the devil.
I have some theories about this.
Okay. So obviously, Buzz is there. He's a fan favorite, and then obviously, like the fucking hero of the piece walks into shot. Fuller,
Captain Pisspants.
This time he's switched it up. He's no longer part of the Pepsi generation. He's on Coca-Cola now.
He's more full of urine. He's Fuller coming to a cinema near you.
Literally. Every time he was on screen, I ended up writing a note saying "Fuller loves piss" because.
I would wear that t-shirt.
Every single shot of him, he is there with like a can of Coke to go, oh, you know what's going to come?
There's this amazing bit near the end where he wakes up in the hotel and he's
so
bleary-eyed and he's just surrounded by empty cans of soda. And he's just like, oh, I went on a bit of a piss bender last night.
But then he wakes up, doesn't look like he's actually pissed himself, though.
You were really looking.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to...
Because that small boy pissed his pants, I want to know.
Dude, if you're going to set up that, like, for two films that this dude is a big old pee pants, you expect you're going to get the payoff. I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens in 3, 4, or 5, whether we get like, the full-on, like, piss reveal.
Well, I never watched that Netflix TV show Fuller House, but I'm assuming that's what this is about, right?
Yeah, it's Fuller living in a house that he's flooded with his own urine. He's like, no!
My killed
hubris.
By the one thing I love.
Yeah. Exactly.
We also get Uncle Frank in a very weird scene. Now, they are going hard on Uncle Frank being a douchebag.
Yeah.
But there's a bit where Kevin McAllister has to go into the bathroom to get his toothbrush or some shit.
Yes.
And he's like, no, Uncle, I can't go
this
in the bathroom.
Is amazing.
Uncle Frank is having a shower. And he told me that if I ever saw him naked, it would make me grow up to feel like I wasn't a real man.
That's fucked up.
That is a fuck. So like,
go to your nephew and go like, hey mate, guess what? I've got a massive dick.
I've got a massive dick. And if you ever see it, it will terrify you.
And then this guy, they're in a house with 14 people in it. This grown man goes and has, like, you know, like, he's having a shower in this house. He doesn't lock the door. I mean, you know, like, maybe some households are like, well, it's all family. We're not going to... He has the door open.
Yeah.
And they're not even...
He needs that extra room to swing his big mammoth dick.
Yeah, does he want his brother's wife to walk in and see his donger? Does he want his nieces and nephews? Like, what the fuck, Frank?
Clearly he does. But then when Kevin McAllister comes in and sees it... He records his Uncle Frank.
With the tape player that gets a line before Kevin does.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, we'll just wind it back. We'll get to the big Frank shower reveal in a minute. But this whole, like, when you first get reintroduced to Kevin McAllister, he sat sadly on a bed watching the news, and he's got this directional tape recorder, and you get to see what the tape recorder does before he even says anything. You go like, okay, right, he's recorded something off the telly and he's played it back. Great. So we know what a tape player is. And then Kevin starts talking. It's like, I wonder if they're setting up whether or not this tape player will be of any importance later on in the film. Let's find out. Anyway, it does.
He establishes that the tape player is a thing. He tapes a hotel ad off the telly, like any 12-year-old boy would want to do. He tapes his uncle singing in the shower. And then when his uncle sees him, he tells him to get out, you nosy little pervert.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know, complex much? Like,
yeah, I know. But then the thing I like, the little capper on that is that as Kevin is running away, Frank gets right back to singing in the shower and just goes, oh, Frankie!
Which is his own name.
Yeah. Wild. That was all great stuff.
Lots to unpack.
So the reason he had to go and get the tie from Frank's penis dungeon is they're going to
the Christmas pageant.
The Christmas pageant where they're all... Kevin's got his big solo.
And yeah, yet again, it is Christmas. Now, Tom, are you feeling Christmassy?
Not as yet.
No?
No.
Maybe this will help.
Oh, some mince pies.
Guys, I have just done a stone-cold icing-style reveal of two... two reduced to clear mince pies.
The best kind.
I had hidden them under my coat. Literally. And Tom, you have to eat one of them.
What, right now?
Right
on
now
mic?
On mic.
Okay, fine.
You have to do it.
Okay, fine. Right.
This is going to be excellent audio. Keep telling the story while we eat the mince pies.
Right, okay.
Otherwise, it's just not Christmas.
Okay, fine. All right.
It's a Christmas pattern.
It's a Christmas pattern. They're all singing in this big choir. Kevin's got a solo. And they're all holding these, like, candles, but they're not, like, flaming candles. They're, like, they've got a light bulb in it, yeah.
Yeah.
The nice, kindly music teacher playing the piano, she gives Kevin a look and is like, you can do this, mate.
Do the solo now.
And he does the solo. And then when this happens, Buzz is stood behind Kevin, and he does the shittest prank ever. I don't know if this prank read better on the script, and when they came to shoot it, Chris Columbus was like, oh, fuck.
He's got these electric candles. They're like little light bulbs that look like candles. And he just holds them slightly behind Kevin's ears.
Like he's got glowing ears.
That's not that fun. And the audience pisses themselves like Fuller.
Especially Frank. He is absolutely loving it.
He's the funniest shit I've ever seen.
To the point that he will point it out in the following scene. He'll just be like, that bit in the last scene. Oh my God.
And there's a slightly funnier bit after that where Buzz pretends that the candles are drumsticks. That's a bit funnier.
It's a little bit funnier.
Yeah.
Anyway. Still going on mince pies.
Yeah. Then this kind of reminds me of that time that we were watching Police Academy Assignment Miami Beach and we had to drink pina coladas.
I mean, you know, say what you want about us folks, but we go method. We go in. Anyway.
I'm feeling more Christmassy.
And then, so Kevin just turns around and clocks Buzz in the face. And everybody falls over in this big thing of like choir children. And then Mum's like, oh, Kevin. So this is the spilling Coca-Cola on the pizza scene. This is like the big upset. This is actually a bigger upset. And then Buzz is apologising. Now it's like, now, Kevin, don't you think it's your turn to apologise to Buzz? And Kevin's like, nah, he's a fucking prick.
And it's like, because Buzz secretly whispered to...
Oh God, his amazing insults.
Yeah, and whispers to Kevin, "You little trout sniffer." What is a trout sniffer?
What's with this prejudice against trout?
Yeah. It's weird, isn't it?
Mm. You finished off your mince pie a lot quicker than me.
Yeah, somebody sniffing some trout.
Mm.
But yeah, so don't worry, Tom, I got this for you. You finished your mince pie. It's around this point that we established that one year has elapsed. Mm-hmm. This is the next Christmas. There have been no Christmases in between. Family have learned nothing. We see on the news, meanwhile, that the Wet Bandits, that's little Joey Fish's Joe Pesci himself and Daniel Stern, they have escaped prison during a prison riot. That's on the news. Mm. Okay. I wonder if that will come into it. You know it will.
Mm-hmm.
We also missed that the dad was trying to get... He wants like a power adapter thing.
Unplugs his alarm
and
clock.
And so he unplugs his alarm clock. Like
and it resets.
Like a fucking ninny.
Mm.
And so as a result, the alarm doesn't go off.
How did this man make so much money to afford this huge house and afford to have this massive family, but he can't even fucking reset a clock?
I think he's a hitman.
Mm. Fair enough. Makes sense.
I think he's a hitman, Tom. And so they have to do the mad dash again. And then there's a sort of a...
They look to camera. The parents get up and they go, "We did it again." And they look to camera. And any bit time in this film where people look directly down the barrel of the camera, I don't like it.
No, sir. I don't
nope,
like
nope,
it.
Nope, nope, nope. That is not the... That fourth wall is sacred.
There's a decent-ish gag at this point. Like, not an adult gag, but like a gag that kids would probably enjoy where they're all in the car and they're like, okay, we've got to count up the tickets, got to count up the tickets, make sure we don't forget anyone. Where's Kevin? Where's Kevin? And then it turns out that Kevin was sat in front of them where they were looking the whole time.
Mm, yeah.
That's a decent gag.
And I like, during this bit, this thing, there's this house full of all of these people. One person was meant to have set an alarm. And Frank fucking calls it out. It's like, hey, you guys are really stupid. Don't do a real shitty, like, morning call thing, wake up call.
See, Tom, it's hard delivering those lines.
It's very hard. Well, you wasn't eating a mince pie. But it's like bits in this film where they just kind of like, you know, like, hey, that was pretty fucking dumb. How come none of us like set the fucking alarm? And then we're charging on. We're on our way. We're gonna get on the plane.
Kevin's obsessed with his Talk Boy, the little handheld recorder gizmo, and he wants to change the battery so he can play with it on the flight because that wouldn't be ridiculously annoying.
Yeah, but he can't wait. He has to do it now. So he grabs his dad's bag, which he sees has got a fucking shit ton of cash in it, and he's running off with it, and then he stops to change the batteries in the middle of this crowded airport, and he loses sight of the dad and then starts following another guy.
He's got the same coat.
Same coat.
And he goes to Concourse K, not Concourse H.
Oh, big mistake. And this is when you're just kind of like, these parents have learned nothing. They're terrible people. They've just left the smallest child like behind. And then they get to the gate and they're all getting on the plane. So, oh, quick, we've got to close the gate. And the mum's like, oh, and I just need to make sure that everybody gets on. And then the air steward is like, don't worry, we'll do it. You just go and get on your plane. And it's kind of like, what? I think that the mum caved in a little bit too easily there.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, no, actually, I've abandoned my child once before. Let's just make sure that this all goes to plan, shall we? There's also a bit where, like, when they're giving out the plane tickets, where one of the kids goes, oh, how come we're not sitting next to each other? And the mum leans in and goes, because the plot fucking says so, because we've got to lose Kevin.
Yeah, basically.
I like that this film just calls out everything that's happening so many times.
Because
there's, like, a bit when, like... When Kevin gets on the wrong plane and ends up in New York, he's waiting for his family to come off the plane, and an air steward has to come off and goes, we're the last ones on the plane, and walks, you know, they have to like signpost everything. When the Wet Bandits show up, they go like, wow, Marv, it's so good that we broke out of prison. Now it's time to do that one big last job, and then we can buy fake passports and get out of the country. It's like, fucking hell, everybody stop narrating your lives.
It is for kids, Tom. It is for kids.
Yeah, but then there's a little bit of show, don't tell.
Yeah, okay.
You know, like, there are ways around that. Like, the air steward could have just come off the plane and not said that, and you could have just inferred.
We would have inferred.
Yes. Anywho, Kev gets on the wrong fucking plane. Also, just want to note, parents, they went first class again. Put the kids in coach. They're such shitbags.
And they're paying for it.
Mm.
Kevin doesn't hear any of the announcements on the plane because he's got his headphones on because he's listening to his Talk Boy. And he lands in New York and he's walking around the airport and he goes up to this big window and it's just got like the most picture postcard view across the water of all of the skyscrapers of New York. Now, is there an airport in New York that gives you that view from a big window that you can press up against? Because I've been to New York quite a few times, and it's normally a good sort of hour outside of the actual city.
Yeah, I don't think you get that. Like, JFK doesn't... No. I don't think it's got a view of Manhattan, has
no,
it?
No, not like that. It's not like that. You don't land on fucking Liberty.
Yeah, and then Kevin goes up to somebody at one of the check-in desks, and he goes, excuse me, miss, and she looks at him like he is garbage.
Because he is.
Yes, well, obviously. But there's this whole thing in this film where adults just treat a child on his own like absolute scum. Like, that's what happens, like, when he gets to the hotel and Tim Curry is the concierge in the hotel. And as soon as he sees Kevin, he hasn't even had a line yet. They haven't had any interaction. And you can see, he's like, oh, him. I'm going to fuck him up. What's his fucking game? Yeah. What you doing in here, son?
I just don't like your fucking face.
Yeah. So Kev's like, well, I'm in New York. It's like, this is great. I didn't want to be with my family. I didn't want to go to Florida because Christmas is about having a Christmas tree. This is like a big thing for him. He's like, why do you want to go to somewhere sunny for Christmas?
Yeah, this is one of my pre-established character traits, that I love Christmas trees. Don't you remember that from the last film? That was a major plot point for me, remember? Remember how I was constantly for 2 hours talking about Christmas trees all the time? Everybody knows that I love Christmas trees. Everyone understands that, right? We all know that's one of my character traits. Definitely brought it up before. Okay, good. On with the show.
Right, now let's do a going around New York montage. And he goes fucking everywhere in an afternoon.
On foot.
That is not possible. Absolutely. Like, he you could do, like, maybe one of the things that he goes and does in a day.
He goes to all the sites, once again proving my point that he is not lost.
No, he knows exactly where he's going. And then he's like, well, I better go and stay somewhere, hadn't I? I'll go to the hotel that I heard all about on the news. Or whatever, that he was watching.
It was an advert.
It was an advert that I recorded. Why?
He recorded it on his Talkboy.
Do New York hotels advertise on the television in Chicago?
They might do. I imagine people from Chicago occasionally go to New York. And when they do, Tom, they might want to go to sleep somewhere.
They might go to the Plaza. Was that really Trump Towers? Or like a Trump... It was a Trump hotel, right?
Yes. So I have some stuff to say, Tom.
I want to hear it.
So some of our listeners may have seen this interview that went around with Seth Rogen recently, where he was working on some film that was a bit shooting in a Trump hotel as well. And apparently there's a clause, or at least there used to be before he was president, that if you wanted to film in a Trump hotel, you had to write a scene in for Donald Trump. You have to. It's in the contract because he's just this ridiculous...
Because he's a fucking egomaniac.
Ridiculous buffoon. And every other film in history cuts it out. So he was working on something like Al Pacino had to do a thing where he's walking through a hotel and had to go, hello, Mr. Trump. And then like they just had to film that. Hoo-ha. Yeah, and then cut it. So they filmed this, but then they just kept it in because they're fucking dickheads. But I looked up the money. Yeah. I looked up the money behind the hotel. And Tom, I can confirm for you that Donald Trump bought that hotel for $407.5 million, and he sold it for $325 million. Now, Tom, I'm not a numbers guy, but I ran those numbers, and I'm here to tell you that that is a net loss of $82.5 million.
He's such a good businessman. He's gonna be there getting all the good deals for everybody. Fucking hell. Also, like, it's like obviously he's in this film and Kev is just walking down the hallway. He goes straight into the hotel and it's like, excuse me, can you tell me where the reception is? When you go into a hotel, is it not as soon as you get in? So what is your fucking problem, Trump? Why have you built a hotel where you need to go down the hallway to the left?
Because he's a fucking moron,
yes,
Tom.
But then he's like, the thing that really creeped me out is after he's delivered his line, Kevin's walking off and Trump just turns around and just stares at him as he walks down the hallway and it's like, oh, that is sinister.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's just kind of like, look at this. Look at this young little soon-to-be millennial. Can't wait to try and fuck up his life. That's what he's thinking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So apparently some editions of this on DVD had the bit where he goes to the Twin Towers cut out for sensitivity. I wonder if future editions on the Blu-ray will have the Trump scene cut out.
Oh, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Maybe if they do, what they could do is replace it with some more Tim Curry, because he's fucking great.
Or they could just replace it with a bit where when Macaulay Culkin walks into the hotel, there's just a man shitting in a bucket and he's rubbing the shit on his face and he's sucking the shit off his fingers going... Wah, wah, wah. And they just act out the exact same scene where Kevin goes, excuse me, where's the reception? And he goes, it's down the hall on the left. And then he just does another big shit.
Yeah, make America great again.
Yeah. that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and then we can get some more Tim Curry.
If anyone's good with CGI... Please, like, cut
okay.
that in.
Okay. Yes, so we finally get him checking in, and this film just lights up when Tim Curry's on there as the concierge, because he's fucking great.
He's fresh off the back of doing Stephen King's It, the original It.
Yes.
And he's playing the character the exact same way. Like, you could just see Pennywise, the clown, in his eyes. He's so malevolent. And he sees that little boy, and he wants him.
He wants the fear.
Yes.
Because he knows he's got to go and take his nap for another, 27 years, whatever the fuck it is, 17 years. Yeah. There's a great shot of, him doing, of the Grinch from, the Dr. Seuss animated version of the Grinch, and then it just cutting to... Tim Curry doing the exact same smile, and it's just, it's perfection.
Spot on.
Jim Carrey had to put on all of that, prosthetics and all that stuff, and, it was really painful. Tim Curry can do it with, just in a suit. He doesn't need to. So he's the concierge. We've got Rob Schneider.
Yeah, he plays a bellboy called Cedric.
Yes. And then we've got... there's another hotel staffer.
A lady who has no name.
Yes. I mean, no one really gets their name called out apart from Cedric. She's great. I've seen her in a lot of things, and they're just really good, goofy villains. And it's a different kind of villain to the Wet Bandits, because it's more like Kev just kind of outsmarting them and just sassing them rather than just violently murdering them. And then we get some hotel capering now. So we get a bit where Kev uses the tape of Uncle Frank to fool Tim Curry into thinking that his dad is... because he's under the ruse. He's there saying, I'm staying in the hotel with my dad. My dad booked the hotel because he used his funny little tape player. Then we get another bit with the tape player where he pretends to be the dad in the shower with, a blow-up clown floatable pool toy that he had because he was going to Florida.
A clown, you say, Tom?
Yes!
Tim Curry in a scene with a clown that floats.
Oh, my God.
Well, we all float down here, buddy.
Oh, yes, I hadn't spotted that. That's amazing.
It's a magic moment.
We get a bit where Kevin can go and eat his basic-as-fuck cheese pizza, this time in a limo, so that's a bit cooler.
When the limo driver is standing there with the pizza, he looks so proud. He's got this amazing smile where he's like, oh, yeah, this is the shit right here.
Ah, yeah, it's all good. And then Kev's like, let's go to a toy shop. Go to this big toy shop called Duncan's Toys. Duncan's Toy Chest. And he's talking to this kindly old gent who works there, who is saying how Mr. Duncan, the kindly old toy store owner, on Christmas Eve donates all the money that he makes on Christmas Eve to the children's hospital. Just the one hospital they have in New York. He goes down there with a big sack of cash, by the sounds of it. Just dumps it on the desk, goes, give it to the fucking kids.
He's a nice guy, Mr. Duncan.
He's a nice guy. He's a good guy. And he gives Kevin these two Christmas tree decorations, which are two turtle doves. And he does this whole bit saying, you want to give one of these to someone who you really care about, and then you'll be friends forever. And you go okay, that's great, Mr. Duncan. I wonder if this will play into anything later on in the film. Oh, hello, the Wet Bandits are back.
Yes. Now they're the Sticky Bandits, because Daniel Stern, a.k.a. Marv, who really, throughout this whole film, is a fucking tour de force.
Yeah.
All of the great... I genuinely, hyperbole aside, think that Daniel Stern is one of the great physical comic actors.
Yeah.
Of a generation. Because he's just... that guy can take a punch, man. Guy can take a punch better than anyone. But the sticky bandits, because he's put masking tape all over his hand, so it's a bit sticky. And so he just walks along, like, stealing, like, coins from buckets and like hats and scarves.
No one ever notices that he's doing this. They do their whole big kind of like, hey, this is great, Marvia. We escaped from prison. That's really good. And we're going to go and do one big job. And they're going to go and knock over Duncan's toy store and steal the Christmas Eve money. And
it's meant for the children in the hospital.
Meant for the children. That is just tragic. I hope they don't get away with it. And then we get a whole bit where, because we know that Tim Curry doesn't like Kevin McAllister because he just doesn't like the look of his fucking face, yeah?
He wants to eat his soul.
Oh, yeah. And he runs the credit card that Kevin's nicked from his dad and finds out it's stolen. And so when Kevin goes back to the hotel, Tim Curry's like, oh, hello. I think you've been stealing the credit card, haven't you? And then, there's this, chase through the hotel with Tim Curry and Rob Schneider and that, and they do a riff, Kevin gets into his hotel room and he does the whole bit from the first film where he's, playing that gangster movie to, scare people.
This is the sequel. This is Angels with Even Filthier Souls.
Yes.
By the way, I would like to point out that I made a mistake on the last episode. I pointed out that in the original Angels with Filthy Souls, the line is, keep the change, you filthy animal. And I said that some people misquote that as Merry Christmas, you filthy animal. That's from this film.
Yes.
My bad, guys. Sorry.
You're bad. So this bit is funnier. This bit works a lot better than it did the first time around because you've got Tim Curry mugging and gurning and responding, because the whole bit in this, the gangster saying, ah, you were here last night, you were smooching with my brother, you've been smooching with everybody, see,
with Snuffy, with Al, Leo, Cheeks, Bony Bob, Cliff, Little Joe with the gimpy leg.
and they're like, even Clive, and they turn around and the security guard who's there with them is called Clive, and he's like, no, it wasn't me. And so this bit works a lot better because it's actually funny.
Yeah, and then it goes off on this weird bit where the guy in the gangster film is trying to make the lady say that she loves him. And so he's like, I'm going to give you to the count of three to say I love you. And Tim Curry has to get down on his knees and he goes, I love you. He really sells it, but no, that's not enough. So they all have to do it. But then the Tommy gun comes out and they all run and they get the police, but they don't notice that there's no bullets going anywhere.
And then it's just a television turned up really loud, but obviously so loud that people come out of all the other hotel rooms and have a look at what's going on.
If these people ever walk down the streets of New York, they are going to be overwhelmed. They cannot handle a television.
Yeah. Kev is not only running from them, he's also running from the sticky bandits, and he exits out the back of the hotel and the sticky bandits nab him.
There's a really nice callback with Pesci's scarred hand from where he had the hot doorknob in the first film.
Yeah, and then they're kind of like, okay, I've got a gun and we're going to go and kill you because we're actually really proper villains. And this... At this point, Marv just decides that he is going to tell Kevin, just recap him on the story so far. He's just like, okay, so just so you know, we escaped from prison in a riot. We've already had this discussion, me and Harry, but I thought I would fill you in. We've already escaped from prison and we're going to knock over the toy store at midnight tonight. And then we're going to go and get fake passports, but let's just go and kill you now. Oh, where's he gone?
So, which is cool. I get that they do that. That's fine. And interestingly, while they're explaining it, Kevin records it all with his talk boy.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they capture him in a dark, lonely alleyway. And then they're like, right, let's take you to the park to murder you.
I think
just do him there.
I know.
Just do him there.
I think that, I don't know if it's like this now, but Central Park, back then, just had this reputation as just being it's just the Old West in there. There is no law. That is the cursed earth if you go inside Central Park.
Pesci has this line where he says, grown men come in the park and don't leave alive.
Yeah.
I've been to Central Park. It's quite nice.
Well, you didn't go in the early 90s.
Oh, that's true.
So maybe that is it.
The way Kevin gets away is quite interesting. So they're waiting at a crosswalk. They're waiting to cross the road. And there's this lady in front of them. And Kevin reaches out and pinches her ass. And then she turns around and sees Daniel Stern, who smiles at her. And in one of the absolute highlights of the movie, just goes, "Well, hello." And I love it. I could watch that on a loop. And she cold clocks him in the face, fucking knocks him flat. And then Kevin goes, "No, it wasn't him. It was Pesci." And then she knocks him flat as well. And he fucking pegs it.
That's good. That was a good bit. This is reminding me, if you're saying that was one of your like favorite moments of the movie, kind of almost like missed one of mine, but it was actually like a bit where I actually genuinely had a proper laugh out loud moment, which was during the Christmas pageant.
Okay.
That when all of the kids fall off of their big plinth,
yeah,
and they knock over a giant piece of the set, which is a huge fake Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And it fucking smacks the kindly old piano player lady in the fucking face. And I was just like,
some Police Academy shit, right?
Yeah, because there's a lot of slapstick in these films, and none of it really tickled me that much. But this bit, because I just didn't see it coming, and it just clocks her, and I was like, "That Chris Columbus, hats off to you, you did it." Anyway, back to the story at hand. So now Kev can't go back to the hotel.
No, Pennywise is there.
Pennywise is there, going to eat his soul. They all float down there. And then the mysterious brother that his dad has, his uncle who was in Paris, has a place in New York.
So I've been able to work out some of this by freeze framing and checking in the address book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Kevin remembers that his uncle lives in New York and checks his dad's address book. So they are in France, this uncle and aunt. Yeah. They are in France. They are the parents of that extra kid that was with the family in the first film.
Yeah.
They do have a place in New York, but specifically they're listed as Uncle Rob and Aunt Georgette.
Yes, yes.
So we are to assume that
she's the French relative.
She is a French relative. Mm. And that they, so a French lady and an American gentleman have married, had a kid, but they've perhaps
splitting
their time. They each owned the house. Maybe, yeah, maybe she might have owned a house from like a previous marriage, maybe, or inherited,
yeah,
it,
yeah,
something like that. So that kind of, now I'm a bit more across what's,
yeah,
going,
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so he's like, "Oh, well, I'll go there," because there's the whole big problem with what Kevin is doing here is that at any point he could make this stop by going and talking to an adult, by going and talking to the police, talking to anybody. But he's like, "Oh, mate," you know, like at no point does he try and contact his parents. The parents meanwhile are in Florida, and you don't even have the story where like the mum is desperately trying to get back to him. She's just kind of they're just sitting waiting to find out where he is, because they find out he's not in Chicago.
Well, they can't clarify that. I don't if
no because no because they think they feel like, oh, he must have, like, if he didn't get on the plane, he might still be in Chicago. So the police went and had a look, I think, at their house or whatever. Anyway, when they get the hit on the credit card from New York, they're like, "Okay, right, he must be in New York." But their story is just sitting around waiting. You don't have this like desperation from the mom.
I know, I missed that.
But also, I mean, also, like, she has no soul now.
Well, this is the thing. I wonder if this is a good point to get into this theory.
Yeah.
So yeah, she doesn't seem to care as much, does she, that her son's gone missing? And I think it is because she doesn't have a soul. But what she's got instead, Tom, is she's been replaced with something else. She's quite clearly got The Shining, because there's a bit early on when they're on the plane and she's like, "Something's wrong. I can feel it." And the dad's like, "How could you possibly know that? Like, we haven't lost Kevin yet.
Yeah,
that,
yeah,
hasn't happened yet." And she's like, "No, but I can feel it. I know that something's wrong." And then later on as well, not to spoil the ending, but there's a bit where she just suddenly, out of nowhere,
knows
exactly where he is and knows exactly where to go. Mm. So she's lost her soul, but she's gained this gift, this dark gift.
Yeah.
And it's kind of taking over her. And I don't know if I've got my theory. I can't say for sure, but what I think has happened is that there's no John Candy in this one, is there? You don't see him. There's no Yellow King. So I think that part of that trade when he took her soul is that he's actually replaced her soul with himself. The spirit of the Yellow King has moved from John Candy's body to hers.
Okay.
So she has these supernatural powers now, up until the point that somebody nearby needs something from her.
Mm.
And then she'll do a trade and the soul will pass on.
I see.
It's like when I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a TV show called Alfonso Bonzo. I don't know if many other people have seen it. Even a lot of people my age didn't see Alfonso Bonzo.
I haven't seen that.
It was fucking weird, man.
Okay, right.
It was about this kind of traveling, like, caricature of a gypsy guy called Alfonso Bonzo, who used to hang around the school playground. And he could make kids... dreams come true. Every episode he would give a kid their wish and it would end up going wrong and they would regret it. And then the last episode, it got really, really dark where the kid who'd been having all these wishes was just like, oh, I think I just want everything to go back to normal, actually. And he's like, okay, I'll do that, but this time you've got to do something for me. And the kid's like, what is it? He's like, I want you to swap bodies with me. And the kid's like, no, I don't. You're like a 40-year-old man, I'm not going to do that. And then Alfonso Bonzo gets really intense and grabs the kid and he's like, you've got to do it. You've got to swap bodies with me just for one day, just for 1 hour. It's all I want. It's all I want. And it's so dark and it's terrifying. And the kid runs away.
Yeah.
And then Alfonso Bonzo fires a fucking lightning bolt out of his hand, knocks the kid off a wall, breaks his leg. And the show ends with him like... with his leg in a cast.
So do you feel this is going to be Home Alone 3?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this Alfonso Bonzo type thread running through. First it was John Candy, then the spirit with, you know, it's got the ability to dark magic.
We've got The Shining in this. We've got Pennywise is in this. So I assume this is taking place in like a Stephen King shared universe kind of a thing. So I imagine that one of the Home Alones is going to involve going to Maine for some reason.
Castle Rock, Maine.
Yeah.
So I slightly derailed that. And there is a second part to this theory, but I'm not going to bring it up yet.
Okay.
So cool. I'm just explaining this is why she doesn't care about her son anymore, because she doesn't care about anything. She can do anything.
I think she's trying to convince herself that she still has human emotions, but it's like being like a psychopath and like faking human emotion to kind of, you know, like make people think that you're on the level. But she's dead inside. Now, we're an hour through the film. And that is a lot that has happened. We've got loads of shit to try and get through. So I'm just going to like try and bash through. Because like, you're like, right, we've had Tim Curry in the hotel. We've established that he's gotten lost. The wet bandits are showing up. We know what the caper is going to be at the end. We found that the aunt and uncle have an abandoned house. So he can weaponize that house later for the finale. Because they're renovating the house. Which means like it's absolutely devastated, that house. But then we get this whole other bit where now Kevin is just like, actually now he's lost in New York because he doesn't have a hotel to go and stay in. And now New York gets scary. And this is like the scary New York where people see a small defenseless child and they all leer up to him and go, hey kid, are you lost? And like scare the shit out of him. And he meets Pigeon Lady. In the park. She is like the Pigeon Lady, feed the birds, tuppence a bag from Mary Poppins, but on crack.
Do you know that song was the Walt Disney's favourite song from any Disney film of his lifetime was Feed the Birds, Tuppence a Bag.
It's a good jam. And she is Shovel Man for this film.
Yeah, she kind of is.
And she makes friends with Kevin. And Kevin's like, hey, you looked scary, but you're not scary. You're nice because all these birds like you. And this woman is covered in pigeons. And it's meant to be this like really touching scene between Pigeon Lady and Kevin. And I just found it fucking disgusting because she's covered in pigeons. And pigeons are fucking gross.
Pigeons are well gross, mate.
Yeah. And then Kevin's like, oh, you know, you're all right. Do you want to go and get a hot chocolate? Or, you know, like go somewhere warm. It's pretty cold out here. And she's going like, oh, yeah, I know somewhere we can go. Where I live, which is I live in secret in the attic of Carnegie Hall, which I just sneak into every day and absolutely nobody stops me from going into the attic of Carnegie Hall covered in fucking pigeons. Okay, fine. We won't dwell on this too much. It's just like they just wanted to put more New York shit in there.
Interestingly, they didn't film that in Carnegie Hall at all, not even the exterior.
Is it not Carnegie Hall?
No, it's meant to be Carnegie Hall.
Right.
It's a theatre in Chicago.
Fair enough. And she's got this whole thing, like how she tells Kevin her sad story, how it's like, I was in love once, but then he didn't love me anymore, and it broke my heart, and so I retreated from humanity and went to live with the pigeons. And then Kevin's like, yeah, that's a bit like me and some roller boots I once had. I was like, what the fuck are we going? Where are we going with this?
Well, Tom, do you want me to tell you where we're going with this? Here's the deal with Pigeon Lady.
Okay.
She is Kevin's mum's soul. separated from the body.
Yes.
So yes, of course. So when the Yellow King was like, all right, well, I've got this mother's soul now. What am I going to do with it? Well, I think I want to try playing around in her body a bit and see what sort of havoc I can wreak. Problem is, when the Yellow King moves from body to body, Yellow King loses the memories of the previous body. So all of a sudden, goes in, it's like, oh, I'm this kind of, you know, middle-aged woman
He's
now.
Just
this
sentiment
is great.
And feeling, but no memory.
Well, exactly. But so lost control of the soul that was in the Yellow King's possession, which is now devoid and devoid of any kind of direction and just lost and roaming. So when she says, oh, yeah, someone loved me, but then he didn't. She's talking about the Yellow King.
You've blown this wide open. Yeah. I'm so into this.
And that's why the pigeon lady is kind of just all kind of impotent emotion. You know, she wants to love but can't. She's just a soul with no body. Whereas Kevin's mum is a body with no soul.
Okay.
She can't feel but can do anything.
And this now, okay, so this is so like then Kevin at the end of the film gives her one of his turtle doves to be like, oh, you know, we'll always be together, we'll always be linked. And there's all these moments where he's like, I'll never forget you. I'm always going to be your friend. I'm always here for you, because he's got that bond. But he never asks her fucking name, and she never tells it. And her name in the credits is Pigeon Lady. So this all adds up that, like, the reason that we don't know her name is because she doesn't know her name.
Yeah.
Because she's just a literal lost soul.
Yeah, I know. It's quite dark for a kids' film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite, yeah. And this takes up, like, the second portion of the film is him hanging out with Pigeon Lady. And you're just like, fucking hell, this film is just going on and on and on. And then he suddenly decides, like he did when he was talking to Shovel Man. He's like, got to go and fight the Wet Bandits now. I'm just off to draw up a battle plan and just, like, weaponize a house in an hour, I'm going to say. And then ensues like the big epic finale where like the guy, they're breaking into the toy store and Kevin smashes the window to set the alarm off. He calls the cops and says like, I found the guys who robbed Duncan's toy store. Meet me and they'll be in the park. Watch out for fireworks. And they run off and they go to the house. And then we've got like just like a much more dark, brutalist version of the house fight from the first one. This one made me very like, because it's not in a nice house, it's in like this dilapidated building site, and the violence in it is fucking harrowing, some of it. Like, there's just like the first, it kicks off with Marv having several bricks thrown in his face, and I was just like, this is horrible, this is absolutely horrible.
I really liked the bricks bit.
They've clearly pushed it a bit more. It's just so kind of like and he's got every brick, he gets this new horrible mark on his face.
It's meant to be a bit more Tom and Jerry, but it does come across like Saw.
Yeah, it's just slightly less cartoony than it needs to be. Like, it's just a bit too bone crunching, you know what I mean?
I do. But
because after the bricks, he then gets shot in the ass, the dick, and the face with a nail gun. And it's just like,
oh yeah.
Oh my god. Oh, what? Yeah. For kids.
But through it all, Daniel Stone, who plays Marv, really, I know I've banged on about how funny he is, but like, I think especially when you're younger and you watch this film, you see Kevin throw a brick on the man and you go, oh, Kevin's so funny the way he throws that brick. But the thing is that, nah, man, Daniel Stern is so funny the way he gets hit with a brick. And there's a lot of really good like voice acting. So there's a great bit after he has all the bricks where he's just like,
what? What?
We get some great bits, man. We get a bit where Marv is electrocuted and turns into an actual skeleton.
Yeah, this was actually quite good. And when he came, like, this was a really good moment from him. What else is there?
There's Joe Pesci gets his head set on fire, and the only thing he can do about it is to do a handstand, dunk his head in the toilet, which is full of gasoline and explodes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, we get like Marv gets a massive bag of plaster dropped on him. Like he fucking load of paint falls on him. Like, he's an absolute state.
There's even quite a clever line where they're about to walk up the stairs, and obviously in the last film when they're walking up the stairs, that's when Kevin hits them with the paint cans on ropes.
Yeah.
And they're walking up the stairs and Pesci says to Marv, wait, we shouldn't do this. Don't you remember what happened last year? And Marv says, no. Because obviously he suffered multiple concussions, so of course he doesn't remember.
Anyway, they fight.
It's really funny.
They fight their way through the house. Like they actually fall off a building because Kevin sets fire to a rope that they're climbing down. But they end up nabbing him and taking him into the park. And they're about to shoot him, but then Pigeon Lady shows up, throws birdseed over them all, and they get horrifyingly pigeon attacked.
Like, this is really horrific.
It's like something from The Birds.
Yeah.
And then Kevin sets off the fire alarms, and the police find them, and they arrest him. Kevin once again says thanks very much to his mum's wandering soul. And then off he goes and finds a big Christmas tree, because that's the thing, remember? It's a fucking thing that Kevin likes. He likes Christmas trees, big Christmas trees. And then the empty carcass of his mum
uses the Shining, yeah.
Goes and finds him. And then we can all go back home and be reunited with the family who are staying back in the Plaza Hotel. And they all start opening up all their prezzies, and while they're all opening up the presents, hello, Todd's opening up a box. Okay, it's another mince pie. Okay.
You've got to fucking eat that fucking mince pie.
Okay, I'm doing it.
Eat it!
Anyway, Kevin, they'll start opening the presents for Mr. Duncan, and then Kevin's like, actually, I forgot about my mum's wandering soul. So instantly after being reunited with the family, Kevin fucks off and no one notices yet again.
That was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
And then the capper on the film is that Buzz finds out how much Kevin has spent on room service while in the hotel. And he spent like $960 basically on chocolate ice cream. And then you hear Kevin's dad shouting, Kevin! The thing that gets me... You saw at the end, this is all about being separated from your family. And Kevin meets his mum, and then we cut to the next morning. So you never see the family all reunited. Like, it's just in the morning, everyone's like, Kev's back. Like, they absolutely hate this little kid.
With good reason.
I mean, he's always ruining their holiday.
What I was impressed by is when the dad is like, Kevin, you spent $967 on chocolate ice cream. He screams so loud, we can hear him from Central Park. He's screaming in the hotel room. In Central Park, they can hear the screaming.
The acoustics in the plaza are crazy, because that's how everyone thought that they were real bullets going off when it was just the television. Must be a nightmare. Like, you couldn't go for a honeymoon there.
Oh, God, no.
Everyone would hear it.
That must be why Trump built the place like he did.
You're a fucking perv. He's there slathered in his own feces, listening to people fuck in his hotel. Make it America great again. Anyway, 2 hours long.
2 hours long. Two mince pies is too many, Tom.
Yes, it's drawing me out somewhat. anyway.
That's the movie. The credits roll over some genuinely eerie, satanic-sounding choir music. Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas!
Sing a song for the glorious season! Even though it was very long and had like way too much going on, and is essentially a retread of the first film, I think I like this one more. I like the New York setting. I think there was a lot more to do than just being in very suburban area of Chicago.
I would like it more if it were a little shorter. If it were a lot shorter, to be honest.
You could do there must be like a I don't have time for this shit fan edit of the film where they've just cut out like
we're asking a lot of people for in terms of re-editing this movie.
Maybe someone could just edit down the first two into just like one movie that is all about Kevin's mom's soul.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing what the storyline pans out with that in the next film. Because now that we've established that the Yellow King can jump bodies and that we've got this kind of disembodied soul out there, you know, which is interesting. You know, there's a kind of a shape-shifting element.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that McColney Culkin doesn't come back, but you better believe there's going to be the Yellow King and Kevin's mum's soul.
So it's going to become a supernatural thriller. I'm looking forward to it. But we'll have to just wait and find out next time when we watch Home Alone 3.
Does it have a subtitle?
No, it doesn't.
It's just Home Alone 3?
No.
Do you know who the kid is in it? Is it anyone famous? It's not another Culkin.
No, but this one's got Scarlett Johansson in it.
Right, okay.
But in quite a minor part.
Yeah, I'm sure.
She's the buzz in this film. So anyway, join us next time when we watch a film that I can imagine that absolutely no one has ever seen, Home Alone 3.
Wow. Yeah. Until then, thank you very much for spending this very festive hour with us. I am Todd Jordan.
I'm Tom Denny.
You can get in touch with us on Twitter at BitterEndPod or find us on Facebook at BitterEndPod.
Until next time, this is Tom Denny eating a mince pie. Made a mess.